You're listening to a News Report podcast from TheBody.com, the internet's most comprehensive HIV/AIDS resource.
This is Kenyon Farrow, Executive Director for Queers for Economic Justice, reporting for TheBody.com. Today we're having a roundtable discussing the rising rates of HIV transmission among Black and Latino men. Participating in this discussion are Vaughn Taylor Akutagawa, who's the Deputy Executive Director of Gay Men of African Descent, Sheldon Fields, who is the Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Rochester Medical Center in the School of Nursing, and last but not least, Francisco Roque, the Director of Community Health at New York City's Gay Men's Health Crisis. So I want to thank you all for joining me. I want to ask a question just about what's not working. I mean, most of us are familiar with the various statistics that have come out in the last couple years related to rising infection rates among Black and Latino men who have sex with men. Last year, the CDC released some data showing that MSM in the U.S. in general are 50 times more likely to have HIV than the general population. And we know those numbers are being largely driven by men of color, particularly Black and Latino men who have sex with men. So I first want to ask Sheldon, what do you think isn't working so far?
In terms of what's not working is clearly we're not being effective at getting the message out to a new generation of MSM about how to protect themselves. We're not doing a good enough job. The results speak for themselves. And in that vein, in terms of the types of research that we are doing, we talk a lot about innovation in health science and research, but then the NIH, the CDC, are not the first ones to really fund true innovation. And a lot of innovative things that we can do are at that very, very basic community level that we have not yet been able to connect the community that's most at risk with academic institutions in order to jointly partner to do the types of research that we probably, well, not even probably, that we do need to be doing to produce better outcomes. Because at the moment we keep doing the same thing, and that's the definition of insanity. We're doing the same thing, we're not getting any different results.
So I'll ask also Vaughn and Francisco to weigh in on this, but Vaughn first. So as a person, as Sheldon mentioned, who provides community-based prevention for Black gay men in New York City, from your perspective, what do you think isn't working?
We don't have real conversations that are tangible for the people that we reach. There's no concept about threat personalization. We have to balance the unique conversation between talking about HIV as something that you do not want to get, with the desensibilities of those who are living with HIV, and often the message about living a healthier life with access to services and a chronic man's disease makes the threat of HIV not seem imminent. We don't have classes in which we can actually talk about effective harm and risk reduction acquisition for young men or for men across the continuum. We get them in the room, we mention or allude to sex, but actual concrete demonstrations about how they negotiate sex aren't there. If we follow what our funders want, our funders want us to pretend as if male negotiation of sex is verbal, and it's generally not. If you look at any level of data, it's assumptive, inferential, and people just do it. If you look online, people say, what's up? They give you directions of the house as a click to unlock, and then there's activity. There's no other discussions. So we're stuck, and particularly for a gay organization serving gay men, we have to do an interesting dance around how do we as peers interact with the people in the community, but still maintain professional boundaries.
And Francisco, from your perspective at GMHC, what do you feel like isn't working?
I think there are a plethora of things, right? And I think that I really would like to echo, certainly, the importance of us developing homegrown interventions that are developed with men of color at the forefront. I think that part of the success that we can attribute to prevention efforts in the 80s and the decrease among white male infections in the gay community is the result of an openness in the way that prevention was executed. Gay white men had many opportunities to insert themselves in the creation and design of innovation and of these interventions that were disseminated. There was an openness to how those were created and distributed. And you know, I think that what that does, which is essential, is it gives community a sense of mattering. When men are themselves able to assert agency in a way that they are, in fact, part of the solution and not part of the problem, and they can see themselves as agents of change, I think that what occurs with that sort of a dynamic is that it instills in folk a sense of mattering in the world. You see the impact that you have as an individual, whether you're an HIV-positive person or not, you suddenly see your impact, and so you look to matter. You look to gather more evidence of mattering in the world, and I think that we've created a paradigm where now that HIV is targeting a different community, where there's been this shift, we begin to deal with folks as though they're broken solely. And the industry has become more and more professionalized. And there are advantages to that. There are advantages to seeing more and more folks with PhDs doing this kind of work. But there are also disadvantages because it limits community from being involved in the solution and in the ways in which we address HIV prevention. And so I think that we need to urgently look for ways to include community and include Black and Latino men in the building of solutions.
One of the things that I keep hearing, you know, we hear so much talk in this day and age about syndemics or about the, you know, sort of socio-political economic factors that are driving the epidemic. I sort of hear each of you speaking to issues where Sheldon sort of mentioned and connecting sort of most vulnerable populations to research and research institutions, Vaughn talking about needing to kind of expand and have more interventions that are focused on communication and negotiation of safer sex and harm reduction, and then Francisco talking about community involvement, creation of interventions. And so I think all those things are important and I think can work together, but I also think about there's so much discussion now about looking at the impact of housing instability and homelessness, thinking about the impact of homophobia on the epidemic for Black and Latino MSM and joblessness in the economy, so on and so forth. So I just want to ask you from, you know, again, each of your vantage points, how do you see these sort of larger structural issues as impacting the epidemic, and how do you approach your work with that lens, or if you, in fact, do approach your work with that lens? So we'll go back. We'll start with Francisco on that.
Yeah, so as we look to expand, you know, upon what we just said, I think that absolutely there are a variety of other factors, right? I think that we don't really look at substance use in the ways that we could be. I think that there is a huge lack of culturally appropriate and gay-sensitive substance use prevention programs that exist that folks can access. I think that we are absolutely needing to deal with alcohol and other substances in ways that we have not, and really look to incorporate that into our prevention efforts. I can't tell you, I mean, it's almost 9 out of 10 times that folks report that some substance was involved in their decision making or in the sex that they're having. And that seems to be more and more the case anecdotally from the folks that we're servicing. And so I think that absolutely we need to look there. I think we need to be very real and look at drug laws. We need to absolutely see what the impact of drug laws and incarceration and how we've created these transient communities where folks come in and out and the impact that that has, and design interventions that look to address that and look to kind of work inside of that. I mean, certainly we need to look to have impact and at a policy level and change some of those factors. But I think in the meantime, I think we need to have some really comprehensive short-term solutions that are addressing the realities that these folks are dealing with. And so I think that we need to look at those two issues in particular. Those, you know, those come to mind. And I think that certainly if I were to list a third, it would be access to condoms is something that we assume. I think it's great that the city in particular makes sure that there's condoms readily available in certain locations. I would love to see city condoms in all liquor stores, for example. I think that in certain neighborhoods, you don't have a local health clinic on every corner, but you absolutely have a liquor store on every corner. And I think that it would be really advantageous for us to really push for those types of outside-of-the-box kind of approaches to really increasing access to condoms as well, and really sort of begin to partner on pressuring legislators and to sort of thinking outside of the box and creating some policies around working with folks as part of getting your liquor license, you have to agree to distribute condoms in your liquor store. There's all kinds of innovative things that we could be doing, but it seems as though the climate in which we're in has dwarfed our ability to think outside the box and really sort of, you know, we shy away from that type of innovation and follow suit and begin to sort of all do simply the prescribed interventions that some of us mentioned earlier.
Sheldon, from where you sit as a researcher, I have been in several rooms with you in different occasions and have raised these various issues about the kind of social and cultural, political context in which mm-hmm. the epidemic is taking place. And so, and you're in many of those rooms with other researchers much more than I am. And so the question is, as much as the syndemics or these other terms that people are using to look at kind of structural issues driving the epidemic, I mean, how much is that really rolling out in terms of reshaping a research agenda that's looking at those issues versus individual risk factors?
You're talking about sort of those things that really create the syndemic effect. We cannot ignore the fact that poverty impacts this. The other things that people do in their lives, you know, people are not just simply focused on whether or not I am or am not going to be at risk for HIV. If I don't have a home, a place, I don't have food, I don't have a job, and some of that is playing out a little bit more. Now, if you look at even our economy, we talk about jobless rates. Then you look at jobless rates in people of color communities, and it's always exponentially higher than that of either the average or even that particularly of the white community. So when you don't have access to resources and you get into sort of a desperation mode, there's a whole other thought process that goes on there, or not, that one is subjected to. And we need to infuse into our research paradigms a different way of thinking about how to approach our research. So this very linear way that we have in thinking about how to do research as only like the randomized clinical trial being the gold standard, I don't think is necessarily in this context working very well. We need to do more interdisciplinary teams. As a researcher who has a healthcare background, I'm very versed on that particular pieces of the research. Not so much in terms of sitting down and talking to an economist or adding an economist to my research team going, how do we look at some of these things from a financial standpoint, or sitting down and talking to a social worker, or even a medical anthropologist who can bring a different view to the research team. And then we can start to incorporate some of these other things that have not been traditionally incorporated into research as we search for answers.
So, Vaughn, for you, a gay man of African descent, how are y'all thinking about the social and cultural factors that are driving the epidemic, and how is that impacting your work there?
We do that by making sure that there's a distinctive syndemic orientation. We look at the interplay of mental health, substance abuse, domestic violence, HIV/AIDS diagnosis, our threat for getting it, and homelessness, and what that impacts on people's decisions. We make sure that all of our mental health services practice an adaptive conjoint methodology so that there are clear and consistent trade-offs for what the client wants. We hear a lot of conversation about meeting the client where they're at, and I think we do a great job. The challenge is, without the adaptation of homegrown interventions, is to not leave the clients where they are. So we look at making sure that everything we do is health literate. We're clear about what decisions the client can make and what they're real for them, and how they actually help them move to a position that's going to actually define better health. And we're also clear about defining what a healthy gay man looks like, and once that standard is set, we don't deviate at all. We say, this is what you should be, let's see how close you can get, and help them make sure that they have the other resources available to make sure they maintain that status.
Now I want to move to a couple different trends in HIV prevention that we're hearing more about. As many of you know, the stories in the paper of the last couple of days have named a new HIV test that is able to test new infections faster than the test that we've currently used most readily, which tests for the HIV antibodies, and people seeing this as a way to test people earlier and get folks into care sooner as a way of stemming the tide of the epidemic. We hear a lot of folks talking about the community viral load, right? So how many people in a particular either geographic or community or sexual networks or among, say, you know, Black or Latino MSM, that if we get people into treatment and lower the overall community viral load, that those will potentially decrease new infections. And we hear a lot of those different components under this rubric of like test and treat, right, as a new medicalized intervention model. And so I just like your opinion about the test and treat model as a potential way to decrease new infections and whether you see it as useful and where you see different problems with it. So we'll start with Vaughn.
It's interesting. Whenever I hear the test and treat concept, my first thought is to have a question around what happened to primary prevention. It seems if we just given up on keeping people uninfected. While I think testing and treating is a great medical application of reducing community viral load, it does not in any way address access to care services from a client's perspective. Almost everyone says, let's partner with a medical provider and things are going to happen okay. Most of the testing services here in New York City have no clear mechanism for connecting someone who turns up positive to services after 9 p.m. at night. You do a quick analysis of websites and where people meet. Most of the time they meet under risk behavior after 9 o'clock at night. The barrage of paperwork and getting someone accessing to is intimidating. So while it's great to say that we're going to get people in there, we're going to reduce the community viral load, most people can't give you a clear definition of what they consider community. And for those who aren't out as openly gay or bisexual, they don't know the names or the status of their partners. They don't even ask. They barely ask about condom usage. So it's one clear platform, but I think there needs to be more things used in conjunction with that to actually think about seriously reducing community viral load.
Okay, and Sheldon?
As a medical approach, yes. I mean, we have no doubt that if you test people, they get to know their status. And once they know their status, then one would hope that they would engage in preventive behaviors or be brought into a system and taught preventive behaviors so that they do not pass their infection on to anyone else. We also know that if we put people on antiretroviral medications, we decrease their viral load, we increase the efficiency at which they are able to pass HIV infection on to another potential partner. Those are medical facts. We know that. I agree with one of the things that Vaughn just mentioned, though, which gets us into the whole, you know, do we test everyone for HIV? And I say we only make HIV testing mandatory if there's an absolute guarantee of access to medical service. We cannot, I think it's unethical, to test someone, give them a diagnosis, and not provide them with treatment. Now, as someone who also is very much interested in health policy and is currently doing a health policy fellowship, there was a reason why a lot of things pertaining to HIV was not folded into healthcare reform, because we cannot yet guarantee that the primary care workforce, those initial frontline people who are going to intake a lot of people into the medical system, we cannot assure that they have the knowledge and the ability to deal with people who actually have HIV. A lot of those providers have never had training in HIV beyond what they got in either their medical program, physician assistant program, nurse practitioner programs. They have no depth of knowledge. So until we're able to provide that depth of knowledge to all primary care providers, then we just cannot throw open that floodgate, because you're going to have people who then are going to be severely mistreated and abused once they come into the system by people who just don't know any better. And once those people are turned off to treatment, it's going to be very hard to get them back in.
Francisco, your perspective.
You know, I'll just chime in and say that if you were to ask me, I mean, I would absolutely say to you, I would want as many people as possible tested and treated, right? I mean, that's absolutely certainly the case. I think that we do a disservice to think that we can create this test and treat agenda as preventionists, and that we'll be able to successfully bully our way into having communities of color tested and treated, right? There are certainly cultural factors at play here, and there's a lot of resistance, and folks still, there's a lot of distrust of medical institutions and care. And I think that, again, this takes me back to the urgency around including community in the development of interventions and messaging and the development of our approaches. We cannot expect that folks will just come along and begin to test and treat at higher numbers, because that's how we're promoting our services and because funding streams are dictating that we simply test and treat. I think that it becomes really important that we look for ways in which we can develop interventions that look to actually have an impact at a cultural level on the dynamic of folks who are not looking to be tested and treated as well, right? There, we certainly have access to care issues, but I can certainly speak for myself. Something almost needs to be falling off before I go to the doctor. And that's the case for most men, and that's the case for certainly most men of color. And then it becomes even more complicated when you think about the stigma related to HIV and homophobia and what it actually looks like to access care consistently, and the fact that we are conditioned to medicate ourselves with drugs and alcohol when we are in crisis. And that becomes our go-to. Our go-to is often not to get into mental health services. It's just not. And so until we look to create some creative ways to address that and model behavior for folks and offer up options that meet people where they're at, we will not successfully test and treat high-risk individuals within our communities. It's just going to be, you know, extremely challenging, and we do a disservice to not address that treasury area first.
One of the things I keep hearing a lot about gay men in general and the kind of increase in new infections, and particularly people are often say about young people, right, that, oh, young gay men just didn't experience the mass death of friends and lovers and so on and so forth in the 1980s and the early 90s, and so they don't have a relationship to the disease in the way that men who are older, who were sexually active and adults at the time of the early part of the AIDS crisis. We hear that myth a lot, and there's a sort of a disconnect that people suggest that having that experience of so many friends and lovers and folks dying, or before the antiretrovirals, seeing kind of more people with KS and any of the other sort of markers of disease progression without medications. And so I just want to ask you, do you think that that's true for young Black and Latino gay men, that folks, that sort of thing that we hear a lot, that they just, they don't have a relationship to the disease in the same way because of heart?
No, I think it's over simplification of the argument. While, yes, they may not had a lot of personal experience with people dying, they most certainly have had a great deal of exposure to people becoming infected and what that means for their life. The medications are better, but you know, the medications are still not harmless in terms of the types of side effects that people get. And we're talking about a generation who has not ever not known the presence of HIV in their life. We're talking about them being exposed to this knowledge at all levels within their schools, within the general media. I do not think it's a lack of knowledge. There's another factor here. Well, there's several other factors here, but it's not simply just a lack of knowledge or lack of experiential knowledge related to having had friends die. I don't buy that argument. That's not what the youth that I research, when I ask them about why they do some of the things that they currently do that we know still places them at risk, I get a lot of, I didn't think about it, or in that moment, it just didn't seem that important. I get a certain amount of, I feel like it's almost going to happen to me in any way, so I might as well have fun. And then, of course, as was brought up earlier, there's a great deal of substance use and abuse that is going on that alters their ability to respond to certain situations in the most coherent manner. Primary, which in the groups that I study, is a great deal of marijuana use. And people just take marijuana for granted, like, oh, it's not a drug that alters your thinking. And it really is.
Francisco.
I would echo, absolutely not. I think that while that is true that they did not certainly grow up seeing all these folks die around them, I think what is different about this generation is that they did, however, grow up with HIV. And so it is not a generation that where HIV came along and then they were impacted by it as an occurrence. I think HIV has been with them all their lives. And so they have been brought up around that. They have been brought up with the culture of used condoms and the safer sex and the messaging. And so I always think it's fascinating to me when I'm asked, well, what's the disconnect? What's going on with young MSM or young gay men? What's going on that they're not getting it? The information is out there. And I almost always turn the question around to whoever's asking it, and I say, have you ever had unprotected sex? And 9 times out of 10, the answer is yes. Sometimes they choose not to answer. But 9 times out of 10, the answer to that question is yes. See, we look to be different from folks often. We often look to see how we're different before we look to see how we are the same. The truth is that young gay men of color are having unprotected sex for the very same reason that everyone else is having unprotected sex. For love, for connection, for intimacy, for touch, for sex, for pleasure. There's nothing different that's happening, and we know this. There's more and more studies are beginning to show us that, in fact, gay men are practicing higher rates of safer sex than heterosexual folks. We know that, in fact, gay men of color are engaging in higher rates of safer sex than their white gay counterparts. And so there's enough data to suggest that it's the pool in which we're swimming in. If there's more infection, then you're more likely to be exposed to HIV, given who you're having sex with. And so given that, we need to begin to relate to people differently, youth and otherwise. We need to begin to see people as solutions and not problems. We continue to relate to folks as though they're doing something wrong or different than other groups. And I think that that sets up this stigmatizing sort of dichotomy that really is counter to what we are trying to do. And so I feel that it's very important that in our prevention efforts, we look to lift people up and to highlight what is working and to continue to give people information so that they can make informed decisions. But under the framework of, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. And in fact, what you're doing is not different from what others are doing. And so I feel like that's missing. And oftentimes, it's interesting because we certainly do it with people of color, but then when we kind of narrow it down even further to young people of color, we often look to be different from folks. And I just think that that is one of our biggest downfalls in HIV prevention.
Vaughn, your thoughts?
Sure, I'll echo what everyone else says and add briefly. Again, it's one of those research questions that are incomplete that we've never really studied. We make an assumption that somehow young people don't get it. But we know that they can negotiate sex, they can negotiate resources, they learn enough to size up older men, use them for resources, they connect for various different reasons. But we as men are in the field of science yet cannot definitively say when a man has sex, it's for this reason, X, Y, Z. And we could even exclude biological exuberance. So to say that because they haven't experienced HIV death puts them in a box, and particularly for urban kids, excludes the reality that they've seen death. They've seen people get shot. People in New York have lived through 9/11. They see death left and right. The way they may experience or choose to express it may be different, but we never actually look at the number of support groups you have for people to cope with death. I mean, we have kids that went through horrible situations that would make my hair turn gray, and it's everyday life for them because they know nothing different. If you really want to assess what messes have made it, we need to ask men across the continuum. As a 42-year-old man, I can tell you none of the messes I've ever seen have ever spoken to me in any way whatsoever, unless the guy was cute. And I can tell you what he looked like. I couldn't tell you what was on the message.
Funny.
Being honest.
I know. It's real, right?
Mm. Yeah, you 42?
So I just have one last question. What do you think is working? Or where do you have hope, despite all the, you know, damn it's bad data and everything else that we see? From each of your vantage points, what about Black and Latino gay men in relationship to the epidemic or not gives you hope about the possibilities of stemming the epidemic?
Oh, I'll answer that one. There was a comment made earlier about not just leaving this up to PhDs to study. And while I agree with that, I'll also disagree with that to say it's the type of PhDs that we had doing that research. As somebody who is a doctorally prepared researcher who also happens to be a gay man of color, I can tell you that my greatest hope is now that we are starting to purposefully assert ourselves into the national research agenda with things like the Black Gay Research Group and the HPTN scholars that have just been oriented to their program, that we have a more of a connected way to assert ourselves into health policy with NBGMAC. That gives me hope, because once we start pushing this agenda and start being able to sit at the tables where decisions about research funding and policy are being made, we have a much better chance of doing the types of research that is truly for us, by us, and we stand a much better chance of that research getting at some of those questions that other researchers just have ignored. Because one of the things that I know for sure, if you are not at the table, you are more than likely on the menu, and that's never a good thing. So I have hope.
Francisco.
I, too, have hope. I, too, have hope, and I think that there are a lot of things coming together. I say this a lot, and I run the risk of being cheesy and corny and all that. Call me whatever you the eternal optimist. But I really, I still see beauty in my community, and I still see, whether it be in the House and Ball community or outside of the House and Ball community, and I look at communities of color overall, and I see the creativity, and I see the innovation, and I see how gay men have been wrestling with this and coming up with creative solutions. I think that I am hopeful that we will continue to lift people up. Much of the work that we have been doing here at GMHC over the past few years has really been around lifting people up, and I think that that is evidenced by our I Love My Boo campaign and My Son Is My Life. We are really looking to deal with people where they're at and highlight what's working and the resiliency within individuals and communities in ways that support them. And I just think that's key. That's key. And I want to just echo that I think it is critical for us to allow opportunities for folks to be involved in the process in ways that they have not been involved. And so for me, I'm absolutely hopeful, and I'm absolutely inspired by what I see. I think that the next step is to really get real about what's happening. We need to really talk about serial sorting. It's occurring in our community. Folks are being creative. Folks are coming up with solutions. Folks are looking for ways to protect themselves, to lower their risks. Folks are prioritizing themselves, and they're doing the best that they can with what they've got. And I think that while we are continuing to develop approaches that work for our communities, I think that we need to also highlight what's working and continue to lift people up, because certainly folks are coming to the table and wrestling with this in innovative ways that we need to celebrate.
And Vaughn, what gives you hope, or what do you see as what's working out there?
What's working is that there are now enough educated Black and brown people to go from the paraprofessional level to the professional level. We have inputted every possible means. We're actually listening to our community and actually creating effective partnerships that are both participant-oriented yet provider-efficient. We show incredible flexibility and adaptability to meet the new funding needs. And we're surviving, regardless that there are 8 standing Black agencies left in the agency to serve Black gay men. We're still here. We're still adapting and getting stronger. So that gives me hope.
Excellent. That's it. I want to thank each of you for taking the time out to talk to us at TheBody.com today. Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at TheBody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a News Report podcast from TheBody.com. Be sure to check in at TheBody.com frequently for the latest news and information on HIV, including in-depth interviews with HIV-positive people, researchers, and healthcare professionals.